97.5, 1280 The Zone and the Zone Sports Network. Hans Olsen, Scott Girard. Lloyd's in my ear. Trey Lasso joins us now. Trey Fitzgerald, he's forgotten more about soccer than you'll ever know. Kind enough to join us. Trey, how are you?
Hey, Trey.
I'm great, guys. How are you?
It's good to hear your voice, man.
Oh, it's always good to join you. And I've been listening to the show today, and we can have the anemic NFL franchise conversation after we talk a little soccer, maybe.
Good deal. I want to get into this with
you. It's not that. We're going to be all right, Trey. We're going to get through this. It's a bad time.
No, he's going to come out swinging on the Raiders. That's what he does.
I mean, Lloyd knows. I got to give Lloyd props for sticking to his guns all these years, despite little to no inspiration from whoever's running that franchise.
Here's the problem, and look, we'll get into the important stuff here in a second, is that, you know, for a good portion of both Trey and my life as Denver Bronco fans, the worst season would be what, 8-8, maybe a 7-9 sprinkled in there somewhere.
I feel like there might have been a 5-11 under Dan Reed.
Yeah, that
bounced back with a 10-6.
Yep. Yeah, that 91-92 season. Yep. But other than that, it's been pretty steady. And now it's not as much fun to make the fun of the Raiders because the Broncos have been abysmal the last 5 years.
Well, and the off-field drama with the Bolin kids is depressing, to say the very least. So hopefully it all gets sorted out. I used to tell people, and they wouldn't believe me, that the Broncos won more games in 30 years than anybody else until the Patriots over the last probably 7 or 8 years. But
yep.
That first 30 years under Bolin was a magical run, and, you know, it's going to be hard to recapture that. And I don't know if anybody could capture that kind of consistency, but that's the standard, I guess, that we all aspire to for our clubs.
Hey, Trey, can I take you back quite a few years and ask you about some of the heyday of working with Real and RSL and what you did? I just want to get some of your thoughts. Was that a magical time for you, a difficult time? Do you reflect well on that? Just kind of walk us back to those, you know, great years of Real soccer.
As some people may know, I worked at the Major League Soccer League office in Manhattan for about 8 years. I grew up in Albuquerque. I went to school in Denver. So I'm a Rocky Mountain kid, but after 8 years in New York, I was just burnt out. And, you know, I got very lucky that Dave Checkett said, "Hey, I'm starting a team in Utah. Do you want to come be a part of this?" And I just had kind of met him and some of his partners when they were doing their due diligence about how Major League Soccer is set up and run and the roster rules and the off-field kind of single entity rules, all that fun stuff. And it was just a great opportunity for me to say, I would love to be part of a team that has fans and players and coaches and wins and losses. And I had never been to Salt Lake before I moved here in October of 2004. And now, you know, it's home. Like, this is a special, magical place, as you guys know, and as anybody that's lived here for even probably a couple years. So those early years of RSL, it was magical in a lot of ways because, you know, even though we lost a lot of games, 2005, 2006, 2007, every Saturday it was like, okay, today is the day it turns around. Today is the day, like, we start fulfilling these dreams and these visions that Dave Checkitz had set out for us. And I'm still inspired by what he thought that club could be in this community, but also what Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, Utah could mean for not just Major League Soccer, but the world of soccer. So as Jason Kreiss and Garth Lagerwey kind of got their feet underneath them and we started having success, and then we won MLS Cup and we're going on those playoff runs every year, and then you end up in the final of the whole continent and the CONCACAF final, the CONCACAF Champions League. I mean, we were one game away from being able to go play Barcelona in Japan in really the pinnacle of the tournaments that are available to clubs like ours. So, yeah, I would say it was a magical time. And, you know, I'm still very active in terms of talking to the fans here. Like, I feel like I've got Real Salt Lake in my blood, and I'm hoping that, you know, once once there is a kind of new ownership structure in place, whoever that is or whatever group that is, that we can recapture all that. And that's the fun thing about sports is, you know, especially in MLS, which is such a parity driven league, every fan base, I think, can go into a season thinking maybe this is our year. Like, yeah, sure, Atlanta or Seattle or Toronto might be spending $20 million more on their roster than us, but it doesn't matter. You got to play the games. And if you play the games and win the games and perform well, you can find your way into those magical moments that all of us as sports fans hold dear, regardless of the competition.
So my next question, and you're going to have to treat Hans and I like the morons we are when it comes to soccer. We enjoy the sport. We enjoy watching the sport, but sometimes the politics of the sport kind of gets lost on us a little bit. I think this European soccer this Super League, I thought was it was a really fascinating thing that they had come up with, and then it fell apart fast. Kind of walk us through what happened, what it was going to look like, and why it fell apart so quickly.
Sure. I mean, it's crazy, and I think part of the disastrous nature of all of this is because the billionaires that own and run all the big European clubs that we've all heard of, Liverpool, Man U, Barcelona, Real Madrid, AC Milan, or Inter Milan, they all very secretly and surreptitiously decided that, hey, instead of the kind of status quo structure, as you guys may know, you know, the top 2 to 4 teams in England, Spain, Italy, Germany, a few different countries over there, they go into something called the Champions League. So those are those Tuesday and Wednesday afternoon games where, as you get deeper into the tournament, you do see Barcelona play Liverpool or something. That just doesn't happen regularly. But the Champions League is the richest kind of tournament in the world of soccer. But what has happened over the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years is these clubs have become so debt ridden, and there's just a factor of greed, and there's been a lot of outside money poured into these clubs. So as you guys may know, the Glazer family that owns the Tampa Bay Buccaneers owns Manchester United. Stan Kroenke owns the Rams and the Nuggets and the Avalanche, owns Arsenal. John Henry and Fenway Sports Group that own the Red Sox own Liverpool now. There's a Russian oligarch who is like Vladimir Putin's best friend owns Chelsea. There's some pretty shady other kind of ownership groups that leverage debt from Asian and Middle Eastern nations that own some of these other teams in Italy. So what we saw over the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 days was a backlash from fans of these clubs that were just so angry and upset that this would all be done without their information or involvement. But all this was happening, like the coaches of these teams didn't know, the players of these teams didn't know. They're doing press conferences either before or after the games on Sunday night, having to answer for things that their owners, that are in many cases thousands of miles away, are doing. And it almost, I think there's a lot of people that felt like this could have destroyed the fabric of European soccer, because remember, most of these clubs are 120 years old, and they were started by dock workers or, you know, blue collar individuals from these communities in Milan or Madrid or Barcelona or Liverpool or wherever. And the way the sport has grown in Europe is it's what's called an open system. So you can start in the fifth division or whatever, but if you have some good years, you can get promoted and move up and keep moving up, and then, you know, gain more economic stability, gain more international allure and credibility. And again, these are the clubs in the world that drive the big television and media contracts in China, which is a massive market, in the U.S., which is obviously a massive market, as well as all over the world. So But what's happened is these clubs in many ways have been so mismanaged. And, you know, Barcelona is probably the biggest club in the world. They've got they make $1 billion of revenue every year, but they are carrying $1 billion of debt. And, you know, the Spanish economy can't support that. And what's happened is the way these clubs have been run, they've outgrown the ability for their local fans to support them. And so that's where you see a lot of the anger. And I think in the U.S., we are used to that closed system, right? The NFL is a closed system. Yes, they go off every decade or two decades and sell expansion rights to somebody. MLS is a closed system. So you don't see the teams in like the Monarchs League, the USL, with the ability to just win a championship and go up into MLS. Now, what you do see here in the U.S. in soccer is these minor league teams that if they can really develop an identity in their community, maybe they get, they earn the opportunity to have an expansion bid into MLS. But I guess what's so upsetting, can you imagine, and I know you guys can, because this has been talked about over the last 20 years a lot in college basketball or college football, if all the blue bloods, if Kentucky and UCLA and Kansas and Georgetown and North Carolina and Duke decided they were going to have their own March Madness tournament, or they're going to have, you know, if Alabama and LSU and Oklahoma and Texas and, you know, whoever decided, hey, we're going to have our own, you know, BCS or college football playoff. And no matter how many years the University of Utah goes 12-0, they don't get invited to that party. And that party is the one that ABC and ESPN and Fox and everybody are paying billions of dollars of rights for. And they're just on the outside looking in, no matter. And I think we're sort of at this point, but not completely. There's still at least hope that if Utah wins the Pac-12, right, they get one of those berths. And hopefully that, you know, there's more than four berths going forward at some point. But that's kind of where everybody was at. And you know, I guess the last piece is you have a U.S. banking institution like J.P. Morgan that was guaranteeing $4.5 billion, 3.5 billion euros for these 12 clubs to break away from Champions League. And look, the governing bodies in Europe, which is called UEFA that runs the Champions League, and FIFA, which as you guys know, those bodies, we should not feel sympathetic for them. Those bodies are rife with economic corruption and have been for a long, long time. But it was just so arrogant and greedy, and I think the secretive nature of the way that these 12 clubs decided, hey, we're going to go do this without telling anybody, without talking to anybody, is really what created the anger and the frustration. And it imploded in less than 48 hours. Now you've got not everybody, but a handful of these guys, these owners, John Henry, issuing an apology and saying that they need to earn the trust of the fans back. You've got presidents of some of these clubs that were putting this together while they were on the other committees to run the Champions League resigning because they were all stabbing each other in the back over money. And it's distasteful. And look, I don't think any of us are so naive or romantic about sports anymore that we don't understand that you have to follow the money and that the media contracts end up dictating a lot of this stuff. But at the same time, I think there's still a part of all of us that thinks that the economic opportunity and the opportunity to win trophies and the glory for our team should depend on what you do on the field or on the court. And that was really the core of the disconnect of this whole idea. The last thing I'll say right now before I keep rambling is I don't think this is going away. I think it may be 2 months or 6 months. It might be 2 years, but these 12, 15, 20, whatever, richest clubs in the world, they're going to try and do this again. They're going to try and figure out a way where they can have their own tournament, their own party, where they're all guaranteed hundreds of million dollars a year, regardless of what they're doing in their own country or on their own. They're not going to earn their way into the competition. They want the guaranteed dollars so that they can keep feeding the beast, because they're so highly leveraged with debt. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the knock-on domino effects are of all this right now.
The other element to it is this was a fan revolt, right? I mean, was it the fans that pretty much ended this thing?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of credit, rightfully so, being given to fans, in especially the English fans, because I would say the English clubs have, not that it doesn't exist in Spain or Italy, but the voice of the fan is stronger there. And in some clubs, it's because your fans, they're more than just like season ticket holders like we're used to here. Fans are at various different levels, depending on what country or what club, effectively stockholders or investors. In Spain, they call them socios. You become a member of Real Madrid or a member of Barcelona. And I think part of that fan anger, besides everything I just mentioned, is the fact that they were not involved in the decision to be a part of this. There was not a vote. There was not even a trial balloon floated. This was just sprung on them. And again, I think if Liverpool was owned by, let's say, an English billionaire as opposed to an American billionaire, or if Chelsea was owned by an English billionaire instead of a Russian billionaire, maybe at least some segment of the fans would have given it at least a little bit more of a consideration. I think a lot of it is their anger that they feel like the fans feel like their clubs have sold their souls overseas 10, 12, however many years ago, and that these billionaire owners, which, look, those guys, whether it's Kroenke or Abramovich or Fenway Sports Group, whatever, like, they've spent a lot of money to bring the best players in the world to those clubs, to make sure the TV games are available in every country in the world, and they've gone on and won trophies, and the fans have enjoyed that. So it is kind of a yin and yang, but the voice of the fan and the angry voice of the fan, especially in England, I think is why this thing fell apart in 48 hours as opposed to maybe a week or two.
Trey Fitzgerald joining us right here on 97.5, 1280 The Zone and The Zone Sports Network.
Trey, before we let you go, I've got to ask you, did the fall apart of RSL ownership and what happened there, did it surprise you? And then really quickly, because we are close to being on the edge of break here, really quickly, what happens from here on out?
So right now, the league, Major League Soccer, is managing the sales process for Real Salt Lake. And Commissioner Garber, in some of his media comments last week, said that he hopes to find a buyer for Real Salt Lake this calendar year. And you guys can probably understand that whoever is maybe kicking the tires, I've heard there's multiple groups, they probably want us to get out of the pandemic a little bit. Real Salt Lake will be able to have 10,000 fans on their home opener on May 1st. So that's 50% capacity, which is a higher capacity than they had for all but one game last year. So that's the step in the right direction. But, you know, MLS depends more on fans in the stands, butts in the seats, more so than probably any other North American sports league. All the other sports, all the other leagues have very big, lucrative television contracts that can kind of get you through a pandemic at least easier. But all these 27 MLS teams, you know, they depend on $15, $20, $30 tickets and parking and concessions and all that stuff. That's your, that's your generally your primary revenue stream, or it's roughly the same as your sponsorship annual take. So I think whoever's kicking the tires is probably going to say, okay, let's get out of the pandemic. And then maybe in late summer, early fall, hopefully, somebody signs the deal. Because if you look at RSL being a bigger fish in a small pond compared to other MLS markets, you look at the infrastructure and the facilities of the MLS team, the USL team, the academy setup. The women's team is gone for now, but there is a option to bring women's soccer back under the umbrella in 2023. You know, and those women's games, they got 10,000 fans a game at Rio Tinto. So I think it's a great opportunity for somebody that wants to invest in sports, but I completely understand, as I think you guys do, why somebody might want to wait until he or she or they, that group, can fill a stadium before they sign on the dotted line. The last MLS expansion fee in Charlotte was $325 million to David Tepper, the owner of the Carolina Panthers, the new owner of the Carolina Panthers. So, you know, this team isn't going to go cheap. Orlando is apparently in the process of being bought by the Will family that owns the Minnesota Vikings. The Houston MLS team is also for sale. Those markets also have their pros and their cons. So, you know, RSL may not be the first to sell because of market size. I'm sure the league doesn't want a lower floor to be set for the purchase of these three teams.
Well, Trey, we didn't have time to break down your new coach at New Mexico and Patino's kid.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't know anything about him except his last name. So yep. We'll see. And maybe we'll get me back on. We'll have a Drew Locke conversation after the draft.
Oh, man, I don't know if I want to do that either. Hey, you're the best, man. We appreciate it.
All right, guys.
Trey Fitzgerald right here on 97.5, 1280 The Zone and the Zone Sports Network.